Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Israel has reportedly deployed extra artillery close to the Gaza Strip, suggesting that the military is preparing for its long-threatened ground offensive on Rafah, the only place of relative safety for at least 1.4 million displaced Palestinian civilians. Now, this coincides with a report today in Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which says the United States has agreed to Israel's Rafah plan in return for limited response to Iran. Well, for more on this, I'm joined on the line by Fergal Keane, who is special correspondent with the BBC. Good morning, Fergal.
Good morning.
It's lovely to have you with us, and we have a lot to talk about, but I do want to ask you about what's happening in the Middle East first. I mean, let's look at what might be coming down the tracks in Rafah, because it appeared that Israel's allies, especially the United States, had held Benjamin Netanyahu back from striking Rafah. But that attack by Iran, that just seems to have changed the dynamic. I mean, do you think, as has been reported in Israel, that Israel has said now, we won't hit back at Iran, but you need to allow us to go into Rafah, and that the Americans might have agreed to that?
Look, I think we have to, the thing you need to do with this story, probably more than any other I've ever covered and any conflict I've ever covered, is have a huge caveat, because everything that we're hearing is coming from anonymous sources. Now, whether those sources are in Cairo, whether they're in Qatar, whether they're in Jerusalem or indeed Washington, everybody has an agenda here. And has, you know, an interest in you know, creating impressions ahead of any action that might or might not be taken. So having said that, look, what do we know? We know that Israel has for the past week or so been contemplating, been having war cabinet meetings about the nature of their response to the Iranian attack. I'm pretty certain there will be a response. The question is, does Israel hit Iran's proxies in the region, or does it launch an attack of some kind directly on Iranian territory? If it goes for an attack on Iranian territory, what will be the scale of that? Will they simply attack a military installation, or will they try and do something wider? Will they try and take out key personnel, as they did indeed with the raid in Syria, which, you know, led in turn to the Iranian attack? So these are all factors that are in the air at the moment. Now, the idea that if you know, these reports, which are first, I think, sourced out of Cairo, that the Americans have said, yes, you can go into Rafah if you are limited in what you do in terms of retaliating against Iran. You have to ask yourself, that is the Americans putting themselves in quite a precarious position, because nobody knows what's going to happen if the IDF goes into Rafah, what the scale of human displacement and human suffering is going to be. One can make a pretty good guess at it. And if America is, you know, seen to have said, you know, given the green light for that, then there will be questions for the Biden administration, certainly from within the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which has been showing increasing unease about the conduct of the war and about American foreign policy, and more globally. So I think we just need to be extremely cautious about the kind of reports that we're hearing, except that I do think there's going to be an Israeli response to the Iranian attack. What form it takes, we have to wait and see.
The Americans are in a really tricky position. I mean, they had managed to navigate that line where they were, you know, wagging the finger at Israel over what was happening in Gaza. And then you have this attack from Iran, and that forces President Biden to come out and say that when it comes to defending against Iran, you know, our solidarity with Israel is ironclad. It pulled them right back in, didn't it, on the side of Israel that moment?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think the difficulty for Washington is that, you know, once you're into this cycle of attack and then response and retaliation, you don't really know where this is going. Now, ask yourself, do the Iranians and do the Israelis want a full-scale war? I don't think either side does, you know, because where, you know, it's really difficult to say where that ends up, given the kind of military power available to both sides. And there are the risks for the regime in Tehran, an authoritarian regime, deeply unpopular with its own people, of getting into a full-scale war with the Israelis is huge. And for the Israelis, who are, you know, fighting in Gaza, who are under increasing pressure on the northern border to respond to Hezbollah attacks. You saw yesterday an attack in which 17 IDF reservists were wounded by a drone launched from Lebanon. You know, do they really need a big conflict with Iran at the moment, and one that would be very likely to you know, put pressure on Washington to in turn put pressure on the Israelis? So it's a complex situation with a very rapidly evolving mm-hmm. dynamic. The problem is, while it may not be in their interests, while they may not even want it, both sides could find themselves in this escalatory cycle that drags them into a much bigger conflict.
And the Qataris,
and that's bad news for everyone.
Sorry, Fergal, to cut across you. The Qataris now saying that they want out of their role as mediator between Israel and Hamas. What do you think has prompted that?
I think that the clear sense is that these talks are not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've been following this, you know, the sort of negotiations since post October 7th, when Hamas launched their attack on Israel. And we've had days when we're told, oh, stand by, something is coming, ceasefire deal. We did have that brief ceasefire. But since then, the clear message is that there is no progress, no real progress. And I think the Qataris sense that and don't want to be the kind of the people who, you know, are giving birth to failure.
Yeah, it's very difficult to have any hope when you see that happening, that this will be resolved.
I think that's true. And, you know, for the families of the hostages who are being held in Gaza, for the hundreds of thousands of Gazans who've been displaced, who are mourning their loved ones, this is a desperate situation.
But where do you see the hope? You know, I know that you invest a lot in optimism and in hope, and you've drawn parallels between what you're seeing here and what happened in Northern Ireland. But given that this situation now is in such a difficult place, where do you see this going?
Yeah, I mean, I would sort of make a difference between hope and optimism. Am I optimistic at the moment? No, I don't think any rational person could be. Am I more hopeful in the longer term? I think I am. But I think there's a lot of pain and suffering that will be gone through before we get to a place where either side are willing to you know, come to the point of a compromise that gets the hostages released and, you know, removes the threat that the Israelis face. And an even further journey to go before there is any kind of bigger settlement that ends this long-running agony in that small place. Mm-hmm. Now, when I talk about hope, if somebody had said to you back in the 1980s, or said to me when I was living in Belfast and covering the trouble, that there would be a political solution that would see Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley sitting down, smiling in government together, you'd have told them to get their head examined.
Yeah.
Okay. If someone had said to me when I was in South Africa for RTE in the 1980s, during the state of emergency when Mandela was still in jail on Robben Island, if someone had said, you know, within a decade, Mandela's going to be president of this country with a black and white power sharing, there's just no way you'd have believed. Mm-hmm. The absolute consensus then was that it was going to be a racial bloodbath. And those, you know, peace in Northern Ireland came, peace in South Africa came. So they do tell you that it's not impossible, even in situations that look profoundly intractable. And I don't believe that you can say of anywhere in the world that it can't be fixed. And I don't think we can afford a philosophy of despair. Absolutely not. Because that becomes self-fulfilling. That drags us into relentless cycles of conflict.
Yeah, Fergal, I went back and had a look at your reporting last year from South Africa. You went back because next week is going to be 30 years, isn't it, from the elections that ended apartheid. And I was so struck, as you were, by the people who feel betrayed, who feel really let down by what's happened over those 30 years. And then there was one man you spoke to who said, look, the old system was in place here for 300 years. Do we really expect it all to change? change and be perfect in 30.
I think that's right. And I think you could apply the same logic to, you know, when we're looking at the north of Ireland and problems of sectarianism and problems of mistrust. It took hundreds of years to create that mess. You know, it's going to take us time to get out of it. What is needed is, you know, the key determinant really is will, is political will, the will on the part of leaders. And, you know, the one thing that helped to save, you know, both Northern Ireland and South Africa was there was a consensus, a constituency of people who decided that this was their home, this was their country, and they were going to stay and make the best of it. It's quite significant, for example, that you don't have vast numbers of South Africans fleeing as refugees, and when you're seeing it in so much of the rest of Africa. And, you know, when people stay, when they invest in a society, I looked at the kind of corruption in South Africa, and a lot of my reporting was based around that. And that's, of course, deeply upsetting. But, you know, nobody that I meet in South Africa is in a state of despair, you know, and that's important. You have there a really strong free press, you have a strong judiciary, and you have a functioning democracy, which is going to give the ANC, you know, some kind of a thump at the polls. They're not going to get the kind of support that they once did. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's, look, the story of human history is about incremental progress. Okay, we in the news media now, and particularly in this age of, you know, hour by hour hunger for updates, hunger for responses, you know, we have, you know, forgotten, I think, quite how long it takes to fix things, to get things right.
Yeah, well, I suppose we have. We're looking for instant change and instant solutions often, aren't we? And they don't come.
Blame. We're always looking for the first thing, whenever there's a country, who do we blame and who do we fire, who do we get rid of? Mm-hmm. Which is fine. I'm all for accountability, absolutely. But, you know, the sort of the way that messes get made are often very complex, and they need complex responses and a bit of patience.
Yeah, I saw you were tweeting as well there in the last couple of weeks about Rwanda, because it's 30 years since the end of the start of the Rwandan genocide, which of course people will know that you covered extensively at the time. I'm just going to read people your tweet, Fergal. It began in brutal earnest 30 years ago today. I remember the smell, the decomposing dead, the survivors, the fear, the abandonment, the lessons never learned, those days that seem like yesterday. It is hard to believe that it is 30 years ago.
It is, yeah. I mean, maybe it's a function as well. Somebody was saying to me the other day that, you know, once you're past 50, everything just seems to accelerate. I'm 63 now, and things are flying past. And it does seem, was that really 30 years ago? And it's still incredibly vivid in my memory. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things that I described, the roadblocks, the mass graves, the sheer terror coming up to roadblocks with, you know, drunken militiamen with their machetes, people who'd done, you know, no end of killing in the days before. And the question I ask, you know, have we learned the lessons? I kind of hoped a bit in the aftermath, you know, with war crimes trials, with the setting up of the International Criminal Court, that we might be moving towards some sort of rules-based international order, but nobody looking at the world now would really say that with much conviction.
Mm-hmm. And it is hard, isn't it, to witness all of that and to keep going. And I know you've written extensively about this in The Madness, but that was one of the reasons, I suppose, that you were sent on those jobs, is that you could witness that and keep going. But there comes a moment where you can't anymore.
I think that's right. And I meet friends of mine now, much younger journalists who are going into Ukraine, and for example, and very understandably, you know, identifying with people suffering, forming friendships. And I can see the hurt in them already. And I know that it's going to come back and haunt them in 10, 20 years time. But, you know, when you're young and you're in the field as a kind of correspondent covering conflict, you can't see it coming. You know, you're driven by an energy, you're driven by the belief that you're somehow invincible. And if you're the one of the lucky ones who manages to survive it physically, then it's years later, as I say, that the ghosts come knocking, mm-hmm. And you start reflecting on yourself, your motivations, the sort of suffering you witnessed, and you can get into a very dark place about humanity and, you know, what human nature is capable of, which is why maybe I, you know, like we were talking at the beginning of the conversation, I'm so insistent now on the need for hope, because there is a better part of us, you know, and that's the other side of what I've seen. You know, there are brilliant people, hopeful people, loving people, generous people, courageous people who stop us from tipping into anarchy.
And do you think those younger correspondents who you speak to, do they have more of an awareness now that what they're seeing is going to impact them at some point in their lives? Or do they have exactly the same mentality as you and your colleagues had back at that time, where you just have to keep going?
No, I think it's a much more psychologically aware generation. Thank God for that. You know, like when I was growing up, you know, in Ireland in the 70s, you know, the kind of therapy wasn't, you know, or talking about your feelings. It just wasn't done. And nowadays, people are very, very fluent and very knowledgeable about mental, far more than we ever were. But you've got to set against that the desire of every heads out to a war zone. You know, it's what drives us, it's what gets you to the places where you can tell stories, where mm-hmm. you get the scoop, where you do stuff that is different to what other people are doing, the people who stay back at base. And that's an energy, it's an ambition, it's a curiosity, which you need. And I don't think, no matter how psychologically aware you are, you can sort of mitigate against that drive.
Now, you're coming to have a chat with our Fran McNulty, at the Granard
yes.
Booktown Festival. That's only in a few days' time, isn't it, Virgo?
It is. And now you might well ask how I'm, when I'm in the Middle East, how I'm going to be there. And we're going to do it by live.
From Jerusalem.
But I'll be able to tell them the very latest about what's happening. And yeah. I'm very much looking forward to the conversation.
And look, the nature of communications, even though your line was a little bit shaky this morning, it'll feel like you're there in Granard. It's on the 21st of April. It's at 7:35 p.m. The Granard Booktown Festival, and the conversation between Fergal and Fran McNulty is available to you. The tickets are available on the website granardbooktownfestival.ie, and it's at the School Hall, Fergal, and people will be delighted, I know, to see you there. Thank you so much for speaking to us today. We really appreciate you taking the time. That's Fergal Keane, special correspondent with the BBC.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.